never a wise thing to be responsible for something you don't fully understand. They were able to do things that the legislation didn't allow licensed ILR to do. The church program and the motoring program used to alternate.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which you hear from those who made a difference. John Rossborough.
I was born in Gloucestershire, as my parents had moved there from Northern Ireland when my dad took up a post as a lecturer in biology and zoology at the Royal Agricultural College in Cirencester. Now, there's already a radio connection in that one of his students was Roger Moffat, the well-known BBC newsreader and presenter. And it was something of a family joke that when he came on the radio, my dad would say, "I used to teach him, you know."
On 247 metres, Tony Blackburn will open and swing into our new Radio 1 network.
It was a lectureship at the Belfast College of Technology that brought the family back, and we moved to a small village 3 miles away called Crossnacreevy in the Castlereagh Hills. It was an ideal situation. We were only 3 miles away from Belfast, but it felt a world away from the big city. And the primary school was literally within a few minutes walking distance, and we used that in the summertime as our playground as well. When I went to grammar school, my interests were definitely along the science lines, and I did maths and physics and chemistry, but I was also interested in languages. I took French and German. I remember that the radio was on a lot in our house, mostly the BBC Home Service and Light programme. Always the Archers. I think that reminded my parents of the place they lived in Gloucestershire. Some Radio Luxembourg, with Radio Erin at times, for the news programmes, mainly. And strangely, they used to close down in the afternoons. I think, inevitably, what you listen to growing up must have a bearing on your outlook on what is good radio, if you enjoy it.
Music station, Radio Caroline Bus Radio, coming your way from the north of England, Ramsey Bay. Tony the Prince banging it in your brain from my throne here in the studio. Now then, the Prince is going to play the King. Elvis is going to sing for us.
I'd listened to a lot of the offshore stations, Radio Caroline North, steamed into reception range just about 2 weeks after I got my first transistor radio as a birthday present, so that was very fortuitous. Radio Scotland was another strong signal in this part of the world when they moved from just off Edinburgh to off the Ayrshire coast, and for a very short time they anchored off Ballywalter in County Down, and that's about 10-15 miles away, so the signal just boomed into Belfast.
2 metres in the medium wave band. This is Radio Scotland and Ireland.
From 242, Richard Park reporting. Broadcasting all day and into the night time too on 242 metres. This is Radio Scotland.
I think it was the spontaneity that was attractive. Obviously, they were playing the popular music of the time, and apart from going out and buying the records or listening to the meagre amount of pop music on the Light programme, it was the source of the music you wanted to hear. But the way in which it was presented was anarchic in a way. It was devil may care. It was a bit dangerous. And that's something that's going to appeal to a teenage audience.
This is the first occasion on which the new year has been welcomed over the Isle of Man's own radio station. A Manx radio, like the year 1965, is now in its infancy. And although its birth has been a little troublesome, I'm confident that, properly nursed and supported, it will fulfill its youthful promise.
Manx radio was interesting because it predated any other local commercial radio in the British Isles. They were licensed by the Isle of Man Broadcasting Commission. They've had different names over the years, and their rules were what they made up themselves. It sounded more like American radio in a way. They had sponsored programmes. You could hear religious programmes in the evenings and on 188 in the mornings, which brought in revenue for them. And it was a curiosity. It was a station serving around 60,000 people on the Isle of Man. Very localised, very community. The news could be that Mrs. Carusha's cat had been trapped up a tree. I know that's a bit of an old trope, but that's the kind of news that Manx Radio wouldn't not consider broadcasting. And because Northern Ireland was such a crazy place in the early 70s in terms of what was going on, the Isle of Man just seemed to be completely a different world. It was idyllic. In fact, I know a number of people who left Northern Ireland to go over to live in the Isle of Man because it was so peaceful and was close by. Added to the fact that Manx Radio was providing music on FM in good quality. In those days, Radio 2, not that it was really to my taste, was poor quality. It was coming down kind of almost like a telephone line.
The Isle of Man has more to see and do. So be there with Manx Radio.
In the early 70s, I got myself an FM, sorry, I should say a VHF radio, it was called that in those days. And that allowed me to listen to two of my favourite stations at the time. Manx Radio, coming in from the Isle of Man, a very clear signal. Radio Blackburn was there all the time, but Radio Manchester and Radio Merseyside would come and go. They were there fairly often, and on one occasion, it was possible to listen clearly to Radio Manchester.
This is Radio Manchester, Radio Manchester.
I had a friend at that time who lived in Warrington and thought, well, it's a good opportunity to do a name check.
It's the capital station of the Northwest.
I phoned Radio Manchester, talked to Ralph Elphinstone, and he was intrigued, I think, to know that their signal was going well outside its intended coverage area. Listening back to that recording, it's kind of me doing a very BBC kind of received pronunciation.
And I do believe that already we have a caller on the line. Hello.
Good evening.
Hello, good evening. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Belfast in Northern Ireland.
Belfast in Northern Ireland. That's a long way out of our region. How are you receiving us over there?
Very well indeed tonight, but it varies. It's good tonight, though.
It's very good, is it? Well, it's very nice of you to call the show. Have you called for any particular reason or just a friendly chat?
Just a friendly chat. And also to say hello to one of my acquaintances in the north of England who's listening right now.
Oh, yes. Well, please do.
I'd like to say hello again to Mr. John Roberts of 14 East Avenue, Stockton Heath.
I was, even at that stage, hoping to make a career in radio because it had such a fascination. And I felt that by studying physics and maths, I could go on and do an engineering degree, which is what I did at Queen's University. I graduated in 1975. And that was just the time that ILR was coming together in different parts of the UK. And Belfast had been identified as a location for a station. So I took a lot of time to find out what was going on, how the project was progressing.
I feel that after a year in the Black Country, I certainly myself feel that I'm part of the Black Country. It's my home now. And I hope that the people of the Black Country...
I remember having a conversation with Jay Oliver, who was a colourful character who had written the application that won the licence for Downtown Radio, as it was going to be called, because it was going to be based in the county downtown of Newton Ards. Jay had mostly led the application, but he wasn't going to be part of the station. But I had a chat with him, and I'd done some production work just in my own little home studio, and he was interested in hearing what that was. I sent it to him, and on the strength of that, he wondered if I was interested in coming across to Beacon Radio and working for them.
Your music is the sunshine.
But I decided, no, Belfast was where I wanted to be if I was going to get into radio. Then Downtown Radio put the advertising into the newspapers looking for staff, and I applied as one of the engineering staff, and having been interviewed, was appointed and arrived there on the 1st of December 1975.
Downtown.
I think I was keen to get into radio, and the way to do that was obviously to use the educational background, but I was very upfront with Downtown, letting them know that I had production interests and broadcasting ambitions. And in fact, I heard afterwards that that was part of the reason they thought my application was strong. And while they wanted hands-on at the start, wiring up studios and putting on Canon plugs, it was something that they were keen to have by way of versatility within the team. So it certainly wasn't an issue where I was applying for one thing, but secretly hoping to do something else. So literally, when I arrived, it was walking over planks to avoid the mud, unboxing all the equipment that was coming in, wiring up cables, and doing all that good engineering stuff. The studio complex was a Rolls-Royce design. It had been very, very skillfully conceived by the first chief engineer, Hedley Riley. The equipment was Audix. They were the mixing desks, and we had Sparta turntables, which had a very interesting ching sound when you started them rolling, which had to be massaged so that it wouldn't be too obvious on air. We had Q-Master cart machines all the way from Australia, and they were quite something. And initially it was Ferrograph tape recorders. They were huge machines. You could rupture yourself trying to move one from one place to another. But certainly in terms of quality, it was a well-equipped radio studio complex. Staff were arriving. I joined the station in December. And then after Christmas, in fact, they sent me over to Radio 4th at New Year's Eve time to see that station and get an idea of how a fully fledged ILR station worked.
This is an engineering test transmission being made by the Independent Broadcasting Authority in preparation for the start of independent local radio in the Belfast area with the programmes of Downtown Radio.
The test transmissions had begun several weeks before Downtown was due to begin broadcasting, and they had been provided by the IBA with music that they regarded as being appropriate for stereo broadcasting and showing off the joys of that. Don Anderson, the first programme controller, in fact, Don is well known from the 70s. He worked for BBC National News and was the last reporter out of Vietnam on a commercial flight.
This battle is critical. Unlike that in the Mekong Delta, here there is a definite front line and a set battle. If the people of Saigon are to retain any faith whatsoever in the fighting capabilities...
And that was before he came to the Times that were Northern Ireland in the early 70s, or mid-70s. The test tapes went out, but they began to get rather repetitive and boring. And I thought, we need some new ones, and put together, I think, three more that had good stereo music and also had my own dulcet tones, such as they were, doing the announcements according to the IBA requirements.
We are transmitting on 293 metres, 1025 kilohertz, in the medium frequency band, and in stereo on 96 megahertz in the VHF band. This is the Engineering Information Service of the Independent Broadcasting Authority.
In January, the other staff were arriving. They were the news team, the presenters, getting themselves trained and prepared for the big day, which had been announced as being St. Patrick's Day or before. And as you know, St. Patrick's is the 17th of March, and the day before was the actual launch day. Going into the station around 5 a.m. for a 6 a.m. launch, exhaustion would be the state of most people. Lots of nerves because of that newness. The first announcement was made by the managing director, David Hannan. Solemn but important announcement to make.
Good morning. It's just after 1 minute to six on Tuesday, the 16th of March, 1976. And welcome to those of you listening on 293 metres in the medium wave or 96 megahertz in the VHF band. In a few moments, the independent local radio programmes of Downtown Radio will be coming on the air. The programmes will begin with a news bulletin read by Michael Beattie at 6 o'clock.
The first newscaster hadn't broadcast as a news journalist before. While they hadn't mostly been broadcasting before, they had experience in local newspapers and were very mindful of all the subtleties and nuances. And in fact, the reality that their news bulletin was going to be heard by people directly affected by the troubles that were going on. And the news editor at the time always made the point that if there was criticism coming in from both sides of the political debate, then probably the station was doing the right thing by going down the central correct path.
A reserve policeman's been shot in the neck during a terrorist ambush in County Fermanagh. And in County Tyrone, soldiers narrowly escaped injury when a landmine exploded. Wendy Austin reports.
The Fermanagh shooting happened shortly...
There were always times when one political shade of opinion or another would say, this is not right, we think you're misrepresenting what we're doing. And that, of course, is something the station would not set out to do. The only period that I remember where the threat word would be applied was during the visit of the Pope in 1979. And there were some indications from a quarter that the station shouldn't be covering something like that. But of course, that could not be given into. The news had to go out at that time. We opened with a song called Peace by an artist just known as Peter. Everyone was hoping that sooner rather than later peace would be restored to Northern Ireland. It was an appeal that that would be the case. And that was the first song played. But if you go to a pub quiz, people will probably expect the answer to be Concrete and Clay by Randy Edelman. That was the first song played in a show by John Paul. And he was so excited that he let that show in the studio in terms of needing the waste paper bin rather quickly.
And first record up in the very first John Paul programme from Downtown Radio comes from, of course, Randy Edelman and a song called Concrete and Clay, 11 past 6.
And the clay beneath my feet begins to crumble, 'cause love will never die, because we'll see the mountains tumble before we say goodbye.
We want to entertain as many people as possible, as much of the time as possible. At the same time, we hope that this new station of ours will be able to bring something new into people's lives. Of course, this means we must make a financial success of the undertaking, because we have to stand on our own two feet.
Amidst all the nervousness and excitement of the first morning, what should happen? Harold Wilson announced his resignation, and that came up on the telex machine, or the teleprinter from IRN. And of course, the Downtown News team were absolutely as keen as mustard, so they broadcast a news flash. And apparently, it was the first radio station in the British Isles to carry the news that the PM had resigned.
This is Rory McLeod reporting. First today's sensation at Westminster, where Prime Minister Wilson has announced that he's to give up the premiership as soon as a new leader is elected. And Labour MPs have already fixed a timetable.
It was an obvious thing to do, because Petula Clark's hit Downtown was very familiar to everybody about to listen to the new radio station. And the thinking was, if Tony Hatch permitted it to be used differently, to make that happen, of course, was to involve him in recording the jingle package, in rewriting his famous melody with the new words for a radio station. He was delighted to be asked, and he also involved Jackie Trent and basically produced a very amazing jingle package that must go down as one of the classics of its time. In those days, it was the only local station. Radio Ulster had started the year before, but it was sounding very BBC-style radio station. It was a commercial monopoly. Downtown was informal. The range of programmes was very wide, because the IBA required it to be. People didn't really know what to expect. Many different interests all had to be accommodated on essentially one channel. It'd be easier to say what the station didn't do. In terms of music, obviously a lot of current music during the day, whenever the hay has to be made. But in the evenings, country was very popular, and still is to this day, hence the launch of a dedicated DAB, Downtown Country. There was folk music, Irish traditional music, classical music, rock, sacred, local bands, actual brass bands and flute bands, and movie music, jazz and blues, and speech programmes as well. Farming, on travel, social issues, amateur theatre, church matters, motoring. In fact, the church programme and the motoring programme used to alternate. They were bi-weekly. And I remember one of the religious advisors, there were four of them, In fact, Ernie Ray was one of the early ones. He rose to become the head of the BBC's religious broadcasting in London. He used to describe church windows being with the four pins, being the four advisors.
Lots and lots of best wishes from millions of people. First one says, "Dear John Paul, I would like to wish you all the very best on 293 for the future, and I won't forget the day your programme starts because I have my practical exam on the same day, and I hope for the success that you
the
will have."
The audience response was immediate. It was overwhelmingly positive. The phone calls were just constant, and many of them went to air, and that led to some very amusing moments as well, as people were being talked to and heard. Of course, heard by the friends. That was all very important in those simpler times.
Downtown, Radio 293.
I think there was an acceptance that radio in Northern Ireland would be likely to be different because of the history of the place and the outlook of the people who live here. But many things would be common with good local radio, in that the station has to be and had to be connected to its area and to its audience. There were subtleties, perhaps, that someone coming across wouldn't necessarily pick up. In fact, I sometimes describe that as the mole syndrome. One of the large supermarkets here in Northern Ireland was selling mole repellent at a discount, which is fine. The problem is, there are no moles in Ireland.
Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Nice and Easy with me, John Rossborough.
My little venture into broadcasting on a regular and long-time basis began in November 1976. The show was then called Nice and Easy, and Paul Prenter, the late Paul Prenter, was the man looking after that until he left downtown to go on to be the manager of Queen. And I'd done a number of fill-in shows on downtown over the summer of 76, and obviously hadn't done too badly because the programme controller, Don Anderson, asked me to take over the Sunday night on a regular basis. I felt that the title was a bit Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin in its suggestion, and that led to it being changed in 1977 to Take It Easy, which conjured up images of the Eagles and music of that kind, which was more what the show was doing. It ran on downtown right through the 80s and built up a regular audience. And in fact, it's quite humbling that today the show is on the air still, although it hasn't been continuously on air. And a number of my 70s listeners are still in touch week by week. And that is really quite something.
For your next quality used car, call at Isaac Agnew Limited Mallet, just past the Michelin factory. We're open late Monday and Thursday till 8 p.m, Saturday mornings till 12:30.
Commercially, initially, I was involved as the commercial producer, so I had a kind of early indication of how things were coming through. Downtown was fortunate in that there were three streams of revenue. Obviously, the local revenue, which was very important because it gave access to smaller businesses. It also gave you a good local sound by the broadcasting of the ads. Also, the UK National coming through from London. But also Dublin was a source of revenue which was important. Each of those three were in a different part of the cycle in terms of ups and downs of the health of the advertising sector. And in that way, the station had perhaps an easier time than other comparable stations that only had two sources, local and UK National. In the early 6 months, things were tight. They had to rationalise some of the things that were being done. But once the audience figures came in and were seen to be sustained rather than just a flash in the pan, then that certainly gave local advertisers a lot of confidence in using downtown as a medium.
Hey there, just because you're busy doesn't mean you can't have a decent snack today.
Bring out the bracer!
It was very quickly obvious that in the evenings, when the specialist programmes were going out, it needed a bit of tender, loving care, because these programmes were being largely recorded for future transmission by non-broadcasters. They were very good at their subject, but they weren't technically right up to speed. The station needed somebody that could help all these people in that part of the team. And also, when the programmes were ready for transmission, make sure they were the right duration, make sure the ads would go in. That led to me being rotated in to the evening shift with the specific duty of running, and indeed recording where appropriate, these programmes. And that led to a little bit of continuity where necessary. a bit like And Now on BBC One. So that gave me the opportunity, with the station's full backing, knowledge and blessing, to make the evening output as smooth as it could be. My first actual live broadcast was a classical music programme, because the deputy programme controller, who was the presenter of that, didn't really want to be coming back in the evenings, and he was happy for me to take the 33 RPM discs in, along with the script, and deliver the programme. And by 1977, they decided to create a new post, that being production manager. Then 2 years later, in 1979, other changes had taken place, and the station was looking for a programme controller. And I had said quietly to them that while I had a lot of interest in the programming output, news wasn't my field of expertise. It's never a particularly wise thing to be responsible for something you don't fully understand. But I said if there was an opportunity purely to be responsible for programming, I would welcome such a thing. And that's what happened. In October 1979, I was appointed as head of programming, and at that time was the youngest program controller in the network. 26 at that stage. Initially, the challenge was to maintain the very high audience figures that had come in at the start of the station. Initially, 70% was the weekly reach. It went down to 58, which was quite worrying. And then, with more work, it got back up to 71%. And I do remember another figure. It's one of these things that never leaves you because of how interesting it is with hindsight. The share that Downtown had in the late 70s, early 80s, was 43% of all listening hours. All of the BBC added together had 38%. That was the way it was. Very different times.
Hendy, yeah. I'm going to stay here and get all my records. They're all lying all over the floor.
Yeah.
I'm going to get them all together, and I'm going to be tuning in.
Any station, once it begins, you have a certain lift, and everybody's enthusiastic, and then that will wane, and people get a little bit complacent, perhaps. And what was necessary was a refresh, just looking at everything, looking in detail at what seemed to be working, based on the jikrar of those days, and look at what wasn't working and redefine what the station was about. That happened in 1978 with a whole raft of new programmes. For example, a children's programme on Sunday morning, which proved immensely popular. And then in 79 through into 1980, basically consolidating, going with what worked and quietly letting things that weren't too successful slip away. I can't really recall an episode where there was really bad feeling between the talent and myself. Schedule changes were always interesting because in those days, and I think it was a sensible approach, the summertime had about a 10-week period of a different schedule. And that meant upset, upheaval, change at the beginning of July as the schools were breaking up. They break up earlier here in Northern Ireland. And then in September, it would all go back pretty much to normal. But these schedule changes were very fraught times on the part of presenters. And even though I would say to each of them, this is what you'll be doing, and we'd discuss that, please don't tell anyone else until everyone knows. I knew full well that they went out, their colleagues said, what are you doing? What are you doing? And that meant people were putting together the schedule before others knew. In fact, the newsroom almost used to run a sweepstake on what would be in the new schedule. One day we had a visit from very, very much on high, a member of the IBA. So best behaviour and best appearances were required. And the head of news at that time, David Sloan, was very, very anxious that his news team would not let him down. They wouldn't turn up as scruffians on that day. So we, for several days, drummed it into them, you must be smart on this particular day. He arrives on the day at 9 o'clock into the newsroom to see the duty editor and the newsreader dressed in full evening dress. So he had to send them home, not to be overdressed. But that was their way of dealing with that one. The original regulation was very, very strict in today's standards. Technically, the station went on with a Rolls-Royce setup, and to this day, the studio acoustics are absolutely excellent.
And in terms of programmes, they wanted to know every detail, any change that was proposed. And because the range of programmes was substantial and they were working, it wasn't an onerous thing to be providing this range of output. You got the impression that the IBA were very keen for their baby to survive and walk and run. But equally, they wanted to be a slightly strict parent to make sure that it didn't go off and do naughty things with the wrong people. The IBA had a regional officer, a lovely gentleman called Tony Fleck. And in the earliest of days, Tony was very helpful in keeping me informed, basically, of the general progress of the ILR system. The nose being stuck in tended to be on the part of the advisory committee, and they would have meetings, let's say once a quarter or once a month, whatever it was, and they were given a range of programmes to listen to, suggestions made by the IBA office. Every once in a while you'd be invited along to hear what these fine people thought of the programmes, and it was very obvious they'd only listened to a very narrow range of the ones that they'd been asked to listen to. And they didn't have a total understanding or feel of the station as a whole.
It's just 5 minutes past six, and if you have an extra attentive ear and you listen regularly to how our programmes start in the mornings, you'll possibly have noticed that I mentioned that we wouldn't be closing at 2 o'clock this morning. I put it in a different sort of way. That, in fact, will be the last time that we'll be officially using the opening music, because this coming evening into tomorrow morning, 1 o'clock, in fact, we go 24 hours, continuous service.
24-hour broadcasting was always a problem when needle time was in effect. And when Radio was launched, it was an answer to that particular conundrum that gave us overnight programmes from 1 a.m. through until 6. And that's how that was done. And when Radio fell by the wayside, it then was possible to have an overnight show, and that could be justified in terms of audience expectation.
It's the Johnny Walker Show on a Wednesday night from the Superstation. Have we got some good music to you?
Have we got some good music to you?
Are you kidding?
In 1986, it became possible to extend the coverage of Downtown from just the Greater Belfast area to include the north and northwest of Northern Ireland. And the background to that was that in Derry, Londonderry, the maiden city, there had been a licence awarded, but the station had not begun broadcasting. So there was a gap in coverage. But in those days, there was an expectation that the Northwest would have its own station. Downtown was a Belfast station. And we thought that in the spirit of the age, by going for an acronym, it would be possible to be more snappy and also start broadcasting in the Northwest with something that wasn't immediately Downtown, because it was DTR FM.
DTR FM, Northern Ireland.
Then in 1987, coverage was extended to the west of the province on FM. And that, in effect, made Downtown the very first regional radio station. And that was some years before the Radio Authority created regional radio in mainland GB.
10:26 a.m., 96.4, 97.4,
102.4 FM. The split came about in 1990, and it was going to be different because at that stage, Downtown was on medium wave in Belfast and on FM in the rest of the province, and it was also on FM in Belfast. But that Belfast FM frequency was going to become a new service, Cool FM. And that meant a different approach would have to be taken, in that Downtown in Belfast would be on AM only. The precedent for that was Piccadilly in Manchester, which had split, leaving Piccadilly on 261, and that hadn't been a tremendous success. But given the knowledge of the local area, and obviously research was done into this, there was a risk to be taken that was worth taking, that creating the new station for Belfast called Cool FM would be a success, and the audience loyalty in Belfast to Downtown would be sufficient to keep a significant audience on the medium wave remaining frequency. But it led to a lot of confusion across the water, because most stations were doing an AM-FM split. AM was Golden Oldies, FM was today's pop hits, and agencies, particularly across the water, couldn't get their heads around the fact that Downtown was on AM, but also on FM, and wasn't an oldie station. So that took a little bit of them getting used to. It was important to increase the number of listening hours to what the company was doing, and that was boosted by a figure in mind of about 40% compared to pre-split. So I think that can be described as a success.
Good morning, and welcome to Cool FM, the new music radio service from Downtown Radio. Broadcasting 19 hours a day on 97.4 FM. We hope you will enjoy our programs, which will feature the music and lifestyle of the 90s. It's just gone 8:30.
There had been competition in the 80s from cross-border radio services, and they were of an interesting nature. The people running them used the euphemism pre-licensed, which was a fascinating word to use. They were pirates, and they were broadcasting across the border into Northern Ireland looking for an audience. And they were very aggressive, in a sense. At one time, 23 cross-border pirate stations. I counted them one night. And together, they had a combined reach of 17%. That compared with Downtown's 60-something. So it was a mouse rather than an elephant that was in the room. But they were there. People could tune into them. And certainly it could be said that they were able to do things that the legislation didn't allow licensed ILR to do. For example, non-stop music in that kind of snazzy contemporary hits format. That wasn't possible in the late 80s until Needletown went and split broadcasting was allowed. So in a sense, they could do something ahead of where legislation allowed the legal stations to be.
You are listening to Dublin's Love Song Station. This is Heartbeat FM and Chicago, if you leave me now. In just a couple of secs, I'm going to introduce you to the man who brought Heartbeat FM through the airwaves of love. And he is going to, unfortunately, bring us to an end this evening.
Beyond that, once the stations in the Republic, the illegal ones, were closed, mostly, then they brought in licensed commercial radio, and that was launched in 1989. Some of those stations came across the border, but not to the same extent. RTE, Radio 1, Radio 2, 2FM, as it now is, was a pop music channel that launched in 1979.
It will complement the existing national radio service, which had its origin in 1926 in that studio in Little Denmark Street, and which has been providing programmes of the highest quality and standards.
And of course, the national services started coming on, national commercial stations. And in the early 90s, there were smaller stations coming in under the Radio Authority, one for Derry, Londonderry, Q102, and a couple of medium wave services around the Mid-Ulster area. Yes, it was starting to hot up. I think the biggest challenge of the 90s was managing what was going to be an inevitable decline in attractiveness of medium wave. If you cannot get your favourite station in as good quality as something else, then you tend to listen less, and that was what was actually happening. It was very frustrating as a programmer because it was possible to listen to Downtown on FM, and in the 90s, a couple of transmitters were commissioned for Mid Antrim and South Down, which had an effect of backfilling into parts of Belfast. So you'd listen to Downtown on FM and it would sound like a bright, lively radio station, but not in the very heart of its coverage. You tune into the same programme on medium wave and it sounded like it was coming through a woolly sock. One of the highlights was Downtown winning a Gold Award for a drama that Downtown had produced.
How could we sleep? It was so deathly quiet. We were all aware of what lay ahead. A few of the guys were more than a shade worried. They thought we were going in too late. Wouldn't it be better going earlier?
Downtown, once a year in the early 90s, was producing a drama. And in 1991, produced a 30-minute drama called Voices from the Somme, because that was the 75th anniversary of that battle. And because my grandfather was in the Battle of the Somme and was seriously injured on the first day, and subsequently, after he recuperated, was posted back to lead the Chinese Labour Corps in France, I was so pleased, so delighted that that programme was judged to be of that standard and, in a sense, marked his memory. By 2000, I felt at Downtown that a lot had been done, a lot had been achieved, and it was time for me professionally to try and do something with a bit more of a challenge. I know it's a cliche. It's a time of mixed emotions because obviously so much time had been spent in that building at all hours of the day and night, and so many memories, so many people, so many friends. Let's be honest about that. But I think while there was shock when it was announced that I was leaving, because there were people in Downtown who thought that I would stay there right up until pension time, but it felt the right thing for me and they understood why I made the move. And a challenge came along the station itself launched in 1990, and that was BCR, Belfast Community Radio.
Yes, Classic Tracks BCR is on the air 24 hours a day with the best music of the 60s, the 70s, the 80s and today.
By 1996, it hadn't really done terribly well and was given permission by the Radio Authority to have a commercial-style format during the day, as long as community broadcasting elements were retained in the evenings and at the weekends. It launched in 1996 as City Beat. And basically, that worked to a degree. The station had in the region of 140,000 listeners, but it was just treading water. It had turned a corner, but found it had a hill to climb. I thought to myself, there is potential in this license. And when they were looking for a new station director, I thought, this is the opportunity to go and not just be responsible for the output of a radio station, but the overall success of every part of the station, commercially as well as output. What it meant was that I was effectively, for the first time, competing at City Beat with my former self at Downtown for audience attention. I enjoyed the fact that it was the underdog. It was something that had to be smarter and punch above its weight, and I was looking for opportunities that would allow it to do that. And there was a good little team already in place. One member of that team was Stephen Nolan. He was looking after the 7-9 magazine programme. That was the part of the output that the Radio Authority required to be community. It was a magazine show, and it wasn't a bad show, but it wasn't all that exciting or gripping. But Stephen wanted to take it in a different direction. He'd never been allowed to do that before. But he was keen to get his teeth into the issues of the day, get the audience on the line and debate them. He did that, and a show that had 29,000 listeners when it was doing its safe thing got to an incredible 61,000 short time afterwards by changing the format.
On the Nolan Radio Show, we revealed how single mother Amanda Jackson was left devastated after losing £77,000 in an internet scam.
City Beat was owned by CN. They had bought it from the local shareholders and just pipped to the post Kelvin McKenzie, who was about to buy it, but didn't sign on the dotted line before CN swooped in and did. City Beat was a fascinating time in my career in that it allowed me to show that I had a range of skills beyond programming and could, as an engineer, as a good engineer, I think, use resources to the maximum effect and benefit. I'm very proud of the fact that during my time at City Beat, every entry that we made to the Sony Awards was nominated. During that time, Stephen Nolan won 5 Sony Golds of the 7 that he's won to this day, and 1 Sony Silver. The station also was the NTL Commercial Radio Station of the Year 2003. So it was a very golden time for everybody involved at City Beat. And you know that old expression that success has many parents, but failure is an orphan. CN were obviously pleased that City Beat was doing well, but the more popular and more successful it became, the more they wanted to be involved without having really the understanding that they needed to have. They wanted to be in the midst of it all. And I found that very frustrating. And Once there was an opportunity, which was coming along in the shape of Ofcom offering a further commercial license for Belfast, I thought, OK, this is the moment. I'm going to have to give this one a go and see what happens by applying for a new radio station, doing it right from square one. I left City Beat then in March 2004, and once it became known that I was interested in applying for a licence, I was getting interesting phone calls. There were five offers to be associated with applications from names you will know and love in terms of the radio world of that time. I had been talking to UTV because Northern Ireland being the big village that it is, I knew lots of the people there. And they had indicated that they were interested in applying for a Belfast licence. They had stations in the Republic of Ireland, and it was a logical next step for them to have a station in their heartland. When it came to the point, decided that UTV would be the best option of the five that were sitting on the table as possibilities. There was a risk in all of this because UTV being a dominant media player with a lot of commercial and editorial influence in Northern Ireland, Ofcom could have said, no, you're not getting any more power. We want to give this licence to another interested party that will give more diversity in the media landscape. My approach was to take what could have been a negative and make it into a positive by saying that the competition for this licence, that is for the station that would begin broadcasting, was actually the older audience, the over 40, over 45 age group, that were currently listening mostly to BBC radio. And if you're going to compete with the BBC, then you have to have critical mass. And in that regard, UTV, with its television resources and output, would be on an equal footing with BBC Northern Ireland, with its resources and output. And that's the argument put to Ofcom. There were 10 other applications. All the applicants were told that the call would come to the successful applicant at 4:30. I'm sitting in my office and lots of people are starting to gather outside in the corridor, hoping not to be seen or heard. One thing that was putting me under pressure was that UTV News had said, can we film this phone call if it comes? And initially I wasn't terribly keen on that because what if the phone didn't ring? That would be embarrassing. However, I thought to myself afterwards, if the call comes, it needs to be captured on film. The camera was there looking at me. The people were in the corridor. 4:28, the phone rings. And I think, who is phoning at this time? Don't they realise I'm waiting for a very important call? But it was Ofcom to say that U105 were going to be awarded the licence.
Just looking at your text so far this morning, you've lost faith or you're losing faith.
The arrangement with UTV was that in the event of a successful outcome, I would then be the managing director of the new station, U105. Good to have a licence, then you've got to get your act together and really make things happen. And that's where the whole UTV setup was immensely helpful. They had identified somewhere in the building where the station could go. It was possible on award of licence in March to promise to be on the air before the end of the year. And U105 went on air on the 14th of November. As managing director, I was responsible for recruiting the entire staff of the station across all the different disciplines, as with the early days of Downtown. But the difference was that many of the people applying had the experience, so we knew they could hit the ground running. And that's what happened. In fact, it was said when the station began broadcasting, it sounded like it had been there for a long time. And I think that's probably the best compliment you can get at the start of a new station.
U105. What's it like being back in Ireland then?
It's always great to be back in Ireland. I've been here so much lately, it's like coming home.
Mm-hmm.
I was just here in Belfast doing a press tour with James.
By 2008, the station had actually exceeded the audience target figures that had been predicted. And I thought to myself, OK, that's 4 years of my life. I seem to be getting into the 4 to 5 year professional cycle. I'll do something else. I'll still carry on with the broadcasting because U105 wanted me to continue with Take It Easy, bless them. But I can do other things. I set up the production company Nocturne Media. I did some consultancy work for Downtown Radio, some for the BBC in Belfast into community radio and how they might help the stations in that sector. I've also been on the PPI, now IMRO Radio Awards Committee, which sits in Dublin and welcomes entries from all over the island of Ireland. And I'm on the Royal Television Society Northern Ireland Centre Committee as the Honorary Treasurer. I regard myself as having the ability to be as busy as I want to be, and that's a good stage to be at.
First, on the city's FM dial and online, this is Belfast 89.
In 2012, Ofcom indicated that more community radio was on the way, and initially Belfast wasn't going to be on the list, but then it was. And in 2013, along with a group of former colleagues, we put in an application to serve the over 55 age group in Belfast, because that was increasingly being left behind by mainstream stations. In the fullness of time, in 2013, we were told we had won the licence for what was to become Belfast 89. It then took a couple of years, which seems a long time given the U105 experience, but this was money where every penny had to be justified and the right decisions made. We ended up finding premises in the absolute perfect location, right in the centre of Belfast, across from the Grand Opera House and the Europa Hotel, on which the transmitter was going to be placed at the top of that building. Recruiting volunteers takes time, and we managed to assemble a very good team of people who had life experience in other fields. We had, for example, a former British Airways pilot, a bank official, civil servants, people who'd listened to radio, loved radio, would have loved to have been on radio, but it just wasn't a career option at the time. But now, given their availability, they were so keen to be on radio and providing a service for that age group.
Libby, tell me, why have you joined the station?
Because I love broadcasting and I love the radio. I think it's much more personal than television. You have to present.
So that was Belfast 89. It launched in June 2015 on one of the hottest days of the year. And again, I think hit the ground running. It also attracted a number of broadcasters who had been on local stations, but those gigs had come to an end for various reasons, and they were keen to come back in and enjoy themselves. And that I've been involved with between 2013 and last year. Disappointment in that is that with a board, as you know, the whole thing about corporate governance is that all members of a board are equally responsible, and you do things by a majority. And in recent times, there had been a majority to do something a little bit different from what I felt was Belfast 89's prime role. So that has carried on. I have stepped aside, as of a number of people, and the station is still broadcasting. I wish them well, but we will see what happens with that. One of the things that does annoy me is to continuously hear radio always described as purely as a brand. I mean, yes, I can understand the shorthand in that, but radio is much more than a brand, which in most cases is something inanimate. Radio is organic. It's alive. It's a combination of lots of different people's talents and outlooks and contribution. Because it's alive, the audience can relate to on that basis. I hope radio will continue to play to its strengths and be the means by which a lot of people can listen to the same thing at the same time. In other words, be part of a community. I think radio has this great ability to reach out into all kinds of nooks and crannies. And certainly when Downtown was opening, it was very much appreciated by the different traditions that we have here. It was something that united people back in those days. I think I would like to be known for being a good listener, not just to all kinds of radio, of course, that's obvious, but in my professional life, to all the people that I worked with, that I would listen carefully to what they were saying, where they were coming from, and give it all due consideration. And I think also act as a catalyst to help make radio that was relevant for the time and attractive for local audiences. and give new broadcasters the scope to shine, because they are the stars, they are the ones that make your station attractive or not at the end of the day. And I feel fortunate to have been able to turn a passion into a profession.